Happy birthday. Happy birthday.
We're celebrating your birthday at a 50s diner, apparently.
Happy birthday.
I feel like we're back in New York and the waiters are getting up on the table to serenade us with Broadway music. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all. And welcome to another episode of season 5 of Three and a Half Gentlemen, the podcast where three of the four hosts provide a refined and intellectual analysis of movies from our private collections while one of us tries desperately to keep up. We'll let you decide which host is which, but for now, my name is Sean, and with me, as always, are my co-assassins, Jeremiah.
Why did you kill that bird, asshole? Yo.
Eddie.
You're going to shoot me, Frank?
And Brandon.
I know things about pigeons.
Aim high is a good one. Aim high.
No, aim you high. Literally just, you talk through mine. I know things about pigeons.
Yeah, I'm just judging your quote, and just that's the best that's one you picked one. Out
it's
of this movie, huh?
It's the last line of the movie. That's the stupidest line of the movie.
Show some goddamn respect.
Okay. Well,
oh, that blow up on the phone. Oh my God. Sorry. God, sorry, Ed.
That's worth a zero. All
right. With season 5, guys, we're changing up things a bit. We still want to be picking movies that we think will be fun to talk about. But for this season, we're playing a loose version of 6 Degrees, where each host chooses their film based off the previous one, as long as the movie shares an actor, actress, composer, director, or writer.
As with every review we give, our goal is to answer one simple question. How many drinks does it take to get through the film that we just watched? Now, at the end of the podcast, we'll rate the movie based on a scale of 0 to 5. 0 being a perfect film that you could watch stone cold sober, and 5 being sort of the film that makes you feel like you fell out of an elevator 20 stories up, going 20 stories down.
Splash it.
Last week, I chose Kerplunk. Space Cowboys, talking about Splat Kerplunk. And this week, Brandon has to use that movie to pick his. So, Brandon, tell us what movie we have jogging at a slow pace alongside the president's motorcade this evening.
Sweating those alcohol sweats.
Put it all together.
Right? So, they had to stop doing that, huh?
Yeah, that's true. No, last week, Sean gave me, he dealt me a really good hand of cards, because I could have gone a whole lot of different ways with a bunch of older actors. And, you know, I really had thought about a Sutherland movie. I really thought about even James Garner. We talked about maybe, you know, The Notebook. My wife and I were talking about The Notebook. Should we do that one? And I said, no, I did Devil Wears Prada. I'm going to go with a movie that is literally an important movie from when I was a kid. I remember watching it. I know it sounds terrible. You watch this movie as a kid, but this was like one of those movies that we'd throw in. We were like, we want a political thriller, and we're going with In the Line of Fire. And we're doing this because of Clint Eastwood. So we're going to be enjoying and talking about 1993's Secret Service espionage assassin flick, In the Line of Fire. Thanks to our good buddy, Clint freaking Eastwood.
In the Line of Fire tells the story of Frank Horrigan, an over-the-hill Secret Service agent who's told that the President of the United States will be assassinated. He joins the President's detail to track down the would-be killer and save the President's life. Directed by Wolfgang Peterson, In the Line of Fire stars Clint Eastwood, the wonderful John Malkovich. Rene Russo.
And
Rene Russo.
I say his name different all the time.
This movie has an IMDb rating of 7.2 out of 10, has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 96 with critics, wow, and 79 with audience.
Really 90 high. Freaking 6.
So that's really nice.
96 is high.
I was unbalanced. Shocked when I wrote that today.
A little unbalanced. Yeah.
As with every movie we review, we try to pair our selection with a drink that we feel enhances the viewing experience. So, Ed, why don't you tell us the drink that we'll be enjoying tonight?
Yes. We're going to be enjoying the Assassin's Cocktail tonight. This drink is brought to us by, I know, right? Brandon's getting kind of good with these ones.
Yeah,
Brandon's
getting crazy.
This drink is brought to us by Bar One Drinks. All you need to do is mix 1/3 of an ounce of whiskey, 1/3 ounce of tequila, 1/3 ounce of peppermint schnapps. Oh, God, this is going to get dirty. Mm-hmm. And a splash of Coca-Cola. I recommend Wild Cherry or Cherry Coke.
A splash?
Even though this is an easy drink to make, you want to watch out because it packs a serious punch. Yeah.
I mean, I can only imagine the peppermint schnapps just taking the edge off the whiskey and tequila just enough to where it fools you into, hey, this drink doesn't make you that drunk.
It well, you can enjoy it with some Rumplemints. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the whiskey.
Reminds me of some.
It takes off
hell yeah.
it takes out that strongness, though. It's like you could drink this and be very dangerous three drinks in.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, three. I find myself, no matter what I drink. Three drinks
in, Jesus Christ.
Three drinks in, I'm a mess.
Do you remember the trailer to this movie?
Yes,
like,
I do.
Theaters, I watched it. Where it was like 1963, he failed to save one president. But in 1993, and like the six turns to a nine, you know, he has one more chance. And then it seriously cuts to like Clint Eastwood. The narration goes, tried to attempt another assassination. And cuts to like Clint Eastwood goes, well, that's not going to happen. In the line of fire. I'm like, oh, shit.
Right. Imagine if he failed. That's two presidents on your hands. At that point, well, do you retire?
That's a great line. That's one of the greatest lines in the movie is when Booth or Malkovich says, you'll be standing over the grave of another dead president. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some wonderful lines in this movie. Yeah. And I did not realize this is one of my favorite. I will admit this is one of my favorite Clint Eastwood movies. Probably my top. It cracks my top 10 of political thrillers for sure. I want to say that John Malkovich's performance is fantastic, but I forgot how menacing he was.
Oh, yeah.
For the first half of the movie, you don't really get to see his face. You get to see pieces of his face,
just his
eyes,
mouth.
His mouth. Yeah. But you don't, and all you have is that voice, and his voice is so meticulous. It's just so fucking creepy that it's soft and calm, and it just makes you like, just, I don't know, it sends us a chill up.
He's a great villain. I'm just throwing it out there. I want to say he's probably one of the better villains of this era
of cinema.
Yeah, I enjoy him. When I see him as a villain, I'm like, ooh, we're gonna have a good one today.
Yeah, no. So for me, I mean, this movie sticks out in my mind because of John Malkovich. It's not about Clint Eastwood. In a lot of ways, I think Clint Eastwood, last week we talked about Space Cowboys as being kind of, a departure for Clint Eastwood. And Sean, I know you were saying, well, not really. A lot of his movies can kind of have this kind of softer, more playful edge to it. And we really see that with Eastwood's character in this movie. And I'd love to talk about that a little bit. But for me, when I think of this movie, it's always about Malkovich. And for me, I think this is the first time I ever saw John Malkovich. And I think probably right after that, with my parents, we watched Places in the Heart, which if you haven't seen that movie, have you guys seen that one? Oh my God. That's
no,
a good
I saw Mice and Men.
Yeah.
Mice Men. Yeah. And he was great.
Place in the Heart was a great movie, but that was the second time I saw him, and he plays this blind, crop farmer helper, in antebellum South. Anyway, when you see Malkovich really for the first time in this role, I feel like you're kind of, you feel imbalanced because of just how intense he plays it. Like this is Hannibal Lecter status, I think. And I know that's a big statement, but I really think that he is.
It's not a big statement. I totally agree with you on that. Hands down, this is one of the best and scariest villains of the 90s. Like, mm-hmm. He owns this movie, dude. You know, I remember he was nominated for this movie, and I was so fucking shocked that he did not win. And then I looked it up. I'm like, who did he lose it to that year? He lost it to Tommy Lee Jones from The Fugitive. I'm like, fuck.
No.
It comes full circle, my friends. It comes full circle.
So did anyone feel the vibe of the Dark Knight Joker? Like, I feel like Heath Ledger possibly took parts of this guy. Cause I felt like that, like he was like that, the way he was talking, and I don't know. I got like a little bit of Heath Ledger, like took parts of this movie a little bit, like just scenes and little aspects of it, because he was like, John was very creepy all the time. And I was just like, dude, this guy is,
I did
like,
think of that.
This guy is, this, he's like enticed with having like this friendship, or like, yeah, I'm the villain and I'm the bad guy and we can't kill each other, you know, which is like, this is how it's going to be.
It's cat and mouse.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. He completes him in a way.
No, it's weird that you bring that up, Ed, because I was watching the movie and I have a couple different critiques about the movie, but one of the critiques that I have that I wish that they had done is to not give him a motive, right? So he doesn't have a motive. It seems like for three quarters of the movie, it just seems like he just kind of going along with the Joker. He just wants to see the world burn, and he just is so unhinged. And when they give him the motive, right, he's this, what do they call him? A washer or wiper, whatever it is, right? He's a CIA assassin, essentially, who's kind of gone rogue.
He's a wet boy.
A wet boy, yeah. So when they give him that motive, like, it makes sense. And I feel like they did it because they don't want to just have it be a complete crazy guy who's out there just wants to wants to make history for himself. But in a lot of ways, I really wish that they had kept more of that Joker concept, which is just to say, here's a guy who has no motive except to just kill somebody and become famous or just to have that power, whatever it might be. So I don't know. Do you guys feel the same way that in giving him the motive, it kind of detracts from his character?
I do and I don't. There's a great scene in this movie, yeah. And we're kind of jumping in kind of quickly to you know, the plot here, but there's a scene about three quarters of the way through the movie where he's laying on the bed talking to Frank, and I believe it's after his partner gets killed, and he says there's nothing left to care about. And Clint Eastwood says, well, I play the piano, and John Malkovich comes back with, I see you sitting in your bar alone, you know, playing the piano and drinking. That's not enough. And that banality of life, that the callousness he's taken with life at that point. Mm-hmm. I think if that is your only motive to kill the president because you're bored, I think is less compelling than the secret, because he ends up unraveling himself and giving mm-hmm. himself away to Clint Eastwood's character, and I think that was way more effective than just being this nihilistic. But I understand what you're saying.
Yeah,
but I even think the Joker, if we're going to compare the two characters, his banality or whatever you want to call it, nihilism was a false front. I think that he actually wanted to. Yeah, he actually had a motive. He wanted to push the limits of humanity to see where their breaking point was. Yeah. I think that it wasn't about not caring. I think he cared deeply about it.
Yeah.
He just hid behind the nihilism.
You were talking about the partner, Sean? Yeah. You know, it's just a known fact. You know, if you're playing Clint Eastwood's partner in a movie, there's a 99% chance you're going to die in the fucking movie.
Really? Don't you love Dylan McDermott?
Every movie he does, he has a partner, and they end up getting shot. Or they end up dead all the time, dude.
Bridges of Madison saying, County? Come on, no.
You have Harry? A partner there, dude.
You have a partner in Dirty Harry?
Every Dirty Harry movie had a new partner, yo.
He's like James T. Kirk, and all of his people are wearing red shirts. Like, literally, it's just everyone's a free-for-all.
But when you were watching this movie, guys, I mean, don't you think, like, man, they don't make movies like this anymore. Like, they 1993 don't. Or anything like that, man. I mean, I was just thinking to myself, like, 1993, that was a fucking good year in cinema, man. Yeah, Jurassic Park, The Fugitive, Sandlot, Rudy, The Firm, you know, like, Jesus, Days that's Confused, a lineup, dude.
Eddie, Days Confused,
Eddie,
yeah.
You and I, Airborne, cult classic.
Air Bud? Oh my god, yeah.
Air Bud. Airborne.
Oh, sorry.
Airborne, Rollerblades, dude. Come on, yo. I'm just saying, do you miss movies like this? Where it's it felt like it was like more for us?
I tell you what I do. The answer to your question, I do, absolutely. And here's what I watch in movies. You like the 80s, okay? You love 80s movies. That's Jeremiah.
And
the 80s had foul language, had sex every, you know, couple
and
of
no
seconds.
No apologies.
The 80s were a very graphic time. Then you turn into the 90s and it's like cleaner. The language got better, but the stories remained gritty and dark and serious. Mm-hmm. And the stakes of the movie were high.
Yeah.
And I think that as you move to the 2000s, everything got washed away. Like all the grittiness got pushed away, and you had movies like Space Cowboys, or everything was lighter and brighter and not so noir. And I think that transition from the 80s to 2000s really hurt cinema. Yeah. And in the 2010s, it went the other way. It almost went back to the noir type. Yeah. You know, I'm watching this movie, and I'm sorry I'm babbling on, but there's this great scene where Clint Eastwood is walking diagonally across the street. Mm-hmm. And he's walking diagonally across the street to his apartment in the trench coat, and it's raining in mm-hmm. DC. And I'm like, that is such a 90s shot. That could have been in a, I was thinking it could have been a Brian De Palma film. It could have been, you know, any type of those directors. It could have been, actually, this whole movie reminded me of Brian De Palma. Yeah. Go ahead, Brandon.
No, it's all good. And when you're saying that, Sean, to me, the thing that jumps out is the PC, right? The political correctness. And I feel like we got the 90s turned into this, oh, we got to be, you know, uber well, not really the 90s, the 2000s really kind of moved towards this political correctness. And, yeah. and it swung so far the other way, right? We're so far on the other spectrum that we're afraid to say right. different things. And I say that because part of me was frustrated and annoyed. And I think it's because I've been conditioned along with everybody else in the 2000s and 2010s, now 2020s movies. But Frank is a really fucking sexist person throughout this whole movie. He's throwing all these kind of misogynistic things at Rene Russo's character.
And I saw
she's
that,
just kind of like, you know, yeah, oh,
did he age well?
Yeah, it does not age well. But this is, and in this sense, right, you cannot make this movie. If they brought the script, right, if they brought the script to a production company,
oh, yeah.
they'd be like, okay, well, we have to like Frank every second that he's on screen. But in the 90s, in the 80s, right? I feel like there's this, well, who cares, right? They're more well-rounded characters. There's aspects of these characters that we don't like. There's aspects we do like.
He's a relic of a time gone by in a movie that is now a relic of a time gone by.
Yeah.
So we're like three generations removed from this character. And I think it's so interesting that it almost makes him real or palatable as opposed to being hunky dory.
Well, it's because he has an arc to go for, right? We right. get to see that right. development yeah. over that.
He has a history. He has a good history.
It's going back to the character development, right?
Yep.
The one thing about this movie that I just didn't really care for is the love story scene. I could have done it without it, you know, like it felt like it was kind of like, I think it was in the 90s, like you need to have a love relationship or something. Yeah, dude, it just didn't feel like not necessary to be there in a way, you know. It felt like, you know, like you said, you know, I need to protect the president. Hey, hot stuff, who are you? It's like, where, like, it doesn't balance right there.
Look back, she's interested.
But that's just me. Oh,
Sean,
you know,
Sean's pissed.
You know, now. Little pickies here and shit like that, you know.
No, I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you, Jeremy. However, I think that it was a vehicle to soften his character and to make you actually like a very unlikable character.
I can see that.
Because, no, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, that was a lot of 90s movies too, you know, like you just had to balance that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you could have done it in one of two ways. You could have done it through the partner and through Dermot Mulroney. What's his name?
Dylan McDermott.
I always get those two actors.
They're both fantastic. Dylan McDermott. They both have eyes that pierce my soul.
Be very good. But he could have done it with David Duchovny.
The other guy was in Young Guns, bro, and he was also in My Best Friend's Wedding.
That's right.
That's what we got. Anyway, all right. So you could have done it through, you know, if you looked at the script, you could have softened his character with his relationship with his partner, or you could have given him another person, a best friend, or a love interest, and they chose love interest. Ooh. And I will say that it really bothered me, the age difference.
Yes.
Because it felt uncomfortable. He was in his 50s, over 50.
I did the math, 24 years different.
No, he said over 50. Heterosexual.
Yeah.
Oh. Heterosexual man, piano playing man over 50.
Yeah.
You know, Secret Service is a hard life, guys. Okay. They don't get to see free time.
But going back to Brandon's comment about PC, though, when he calls her window dressing, there's 200 female agents in 2000. That, it's interesting to see that snapshot of where we were in 1983 versus 2024. Yeah. Where I would be very curious to see how many Secret Service agents are actually women and how close the numbers are, how much the numbers have changed. Yep.
Just a real quick thing about this, that if this movie were made now, because I do feel like there's less of a – there needs to be a love story, right? And I feel like there's a couple different ways that movies do this softening of the character now. One is either through like charge of a ward, right? Having a kid that you kind of look after, a neighbor's kid or a niece or a nephew, right? Or a dog, right? I feel like if you threw it now, made it now, you would have to have him take care of something that shows his vulnerability, shows his care, but doesn't necessarily do the love story. And gotcha. Exactly, yeah. But to me, that was a huge misstep. If we're really being critical about this, which, I mean, that's the whole point of this podcast, Rene Russo would not have gone for him. On several different levels. Oh, I mean, just Sean's like, no, I would have gone for.
I agree with you on that. I agree with you that, yeah.
No, I'm just saying Clint Eastwood is a delightful human being. I mean,
Eddie would have gone with him. You know, fun fact, did you know that he actually played the piano in this fucking movie? That he's a professional, very talented pianist?
Fucking so if crazy, you watch right? actually most of his movies, he plays the same fucking character. No, I'm just saying he always has jazz playing. He's always playing the piano. He's like this. He's what I strive to be in my life. And there's a great line toward the end of the movie where he's sitting at the bar with John Mahoney. And John Mahoney says, "You don't spend any of your money except on jazz records." And you look at his apartment. His apartment is very Spartan. He's got a lot of creature comforts, a bourbon, his glass. There's not a lot there. He's lived a very simple life. And I think that, it goes into this question, which I think the movie asks beautifully, of why Secret Service agents do the thing that they do. Because, he asks this question early on, have you met the First Lady? And the president, and he says, I prefer not to get involved with the people I protect.
Yeah.
Could you imagine? I mean, I don't know if we can go around the horn, but could you do that job? Like, would you be willing to take on something like that?
You got to believe in something like really hardcore on that, dude.
Well, here's the thing. Like, I would absolutely I don't know. Maybe it's different. I would absolutely take a bullet for my family. I would take a bullet for you guys. Like, I feel like for me, if it's somebody that I genuinely care for, yeah, I would absolutely lay down anything and everything for that person. For somebody though that I don't know, and not to get political, but my parents, they knew a Secret Service agent. Like, he went to high school or whatever with them. And I can't remember which president it was that he served for, but he seriously disagreed with the politics, right? Just did not care about the president as a person, didn't care about the president as a politician, but still would have absolutely laid down his life for that president. And I think that that's the hard thing. That's the, like, you know, oh, I don't like this person. I don't care about this person, but my job is more important than my life. This person is more important than my life, whether I disagree with him or agree with him or her. And I think that to me, that's the hard thing is protecting somebody that you don't know.
Or you don't care for.
Or you don't care for, yeah.
I think it's probably one of the hardest things to do. I mean, literally, you're sacrificing your life for another person, you know, in the name of, like, you know, what you believe in and everything like that. I think it's fucking tough. I think it's hard. I agree with Brandon, yo. You know, I'll take a bullet for my family. I'll take a bullet for the people that I love just more in the world, you know?
So I was going to say, it's very close to being the firefighter and being a police officer and being like, you go to work and you protect the people, you protect the public very much. And this is, it's just a very heightened, like the top of the peak, of the mountain, because you really can't have a life. But it's to anyone who's in the law enforcement or who's a firefighter, I feel like you're protecting people you don't know.
Yeah.
You know, like, it takes a special type of person to do that. And
it takes a tough person. Yeah,
it does. Cause it's hard on your life. It's hard on you if you have a family and do for a president. And if you don't like it, I don't think I'll ever be able to do a Secret Service.
Do you feel like John Malkovich is kind of the shadow, like he almost mirrors, Clint Eastwood's character. They kind of like
the foil.
They're shadowy reflections of each other.
Yeah, exactly. Cause they both have that thing. Like, they don't know this. They don't know this country anymore, but one went to one path. The other one went to the other path. And, I feel like there is like this common respect for one another in a way. I know Clint Eastwood, he was not giving shit to him. He's like, go fuck yourself and shit, but it feels like there was like this respect, because he even tried to save him in the end when he was about to fall off of the elevator and shit,
Right.
Well, it's just like, do you feel like they're like, the mirror copy of each other?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, Jared. I think I didn't really think about it until right now. Excuse me. But I think that if you really look at Frank, right, you look at Clint Eastwood's character throughout the whole movie, he doesn't really show himself as caring about the person. And Sean, you kind of said it, right? You care about the position. He's saving the position. So he's dedicated to this idea rather than the actual person involved. And I think that is kind of weird, because once you abstract the human being from the position, then I don't know if there really is that much of a difference, because what we got to look at is Malkovich, is not upset at the president. He's upset at the country, right? And it's this kind of metonymous thing where the president represents the country. He represents the government. He represents all those people that, quote unquote, you know, did him wrong. And I feel like in that sense, Jared, they are the carbon copies, right? That Clint Eastwood's character, Frank's he's not protecting the person. And maybe that's how he's able to get through each day and sleep at night. But Malkovich is really very, very similarly doing that. He's not caring about the person. He's caring about this concept.
I mean, practically speaking, if you look at any type of belief, it is vastly easier to believe in an ideal or a system or a worldview or whatever you want to call a system of belief. It's a lot easier to believe in it. Let's look at the Constitution. It's a lot easier to believe in the Constitution of the United States than any person who has to deal with the Constitution.
Yeah,
because people are fallible and weak and stupid and, you know, whatever you want to say negatively about people, but an ideal or a system is strong and it's something you can believe in. I don't think they're carbon copies. I think they're complete opposites. Mm. I think Frank believes in the system. He believes in the sanctity of the government. He believes in the sanctity of the president, office of the presidency. He believes in the United States of America, and John Malkovich has been betrayed by the United States of America. He has lost his faith in government. In, you know, he says in that beautiful when he's on the phone, I think the last time, and he comes unglued, and he talks about how they sent his best friend to kill him in his own home because they can't have a monster roaming the streets. And it's like, that is a complete departure from belief in a system. That is a complete, you know, disbelief or loss of belief in a system.
I think they both have seen firsthand the ugly side of the what it takes to protect the Constitution and the freedom of, you know, the citizens, and you know, they see like the ugly side of this the job, you know, even the John, what's his name, James Carney, what's his real name, I never really
John Malkovich, Mitch Leary, yeah.
So it's like, you know, they both have seen an ugly side of their job of protecting, you know, the America and the United States. So it's, but then one of them still is for it, and the other one is he got broken by it.
I think they both kind of got broken by it. And so I see where you're saying carbon copy, Brandon. I got what you're laying down, Ed. They could be, they're equally broken by the same system.
They chose different paths.
Exactly. They're almost like,
yeah, exactly.
They're almost splinters off of the same impetus,
yes,
or the same cataclysmic event created.
Ooh,
two,
that was a good one,
two different
Sean.
People.
I like that one.
Thank you.
What is your favorite scene in this movie? Because I have two fucking scenes that I think it pretty much makes the movie, you know?
So,
I mean, the phone dialogue, that last one where it was like the calm and the rage between the two chess players. Fantastic. I feel like the last 15 minutes, the final confrontation, it's like the 90s thriller, right, man? It's like it builds suspense the whole time. The music is fucking fantastic. Mm-hmm. There's so much tension. What is your favorite scene in this movie?
So I'm going to steal this one.
There's a lot.
I think all of us can go to that final phone call where Malkovich becomes the Malkovich that we know and love, right? The kind of almost to the Tom Cruise overacting, but still it's psychotic and it's just crazy. And I love it. But the one that I go to, and this is one that stands out when I was, you know, thinking about this movie, and I haven't seen this movie really in years and years until we watched it just yesterday. But the one that stood out watching it again was when he goes so calmly and kills the bank teller and her roommate. And it reminded me so much of Anton Chigurh and how calm and how evil and how calculating this guy is. And to me, that was such a horrible scene. And just the way that he breaks their neck without fucking, you know, batting an eye. And then he looks back at the dog like, should I? And he just walks away. I mean, to me, that personifies evil. And I mean it. I think that we should, in cinema, you know, circles, we should look at his performance here and his character here, at least with the Hannibal Lecters and the Anton Chigurhs of the world. I think that he's got to be one of the top five most evil characters that we've ever seen on film.
I don't disagree with you on that. Eddie.
Ed, favorite scene. So this movie all became – I never thought I watched this movie, right, my whole life. I never thought I never got to watch this movie, you know, because this came in 93, and I didn't recall it. I was always confused, like, did I watch it? Did I not watch it? And then the scene that it was like of memories, it just kept flashing into my head. It's like, oh, I did watch this movie. It was when John Malkovich, the first time that Frank found out, like, they were running through the park with Al. Yeah, and all the other agents, and then John's just like a hippie, and and he's just like doing this, right? And
and then he starts running.
And all of a sudden, it's like, I fucking remember this movie. I watched this movie. I don't know why. And all of a sudden, though, that part, that whole every time that he was chasing scenes, it reminded me of Untouchables with the whole the suspense music.
Same composer.
God, when they're going up the roof and the scaffolding what do you call those?
The fire escape.
Yeah. I'm like, this could be a fucking Brian. This could be a Brian De Palma movie. Every time I got lulled into who directed this? Like Wolfgang Petersen directed this? Because it felt Brian De Palma. I swear to God that Brian De Palma was in the background going like, all right, here's what you do, Wolfgang. Yeah.
Because you know why it felt like Brian De Palma? Because he did a movie called Blowout, which has kind of the same background of this story in here. So it does have like a little thing to it. Fun fact, by the way, remember that scene where John Malkovich puts his mouth on the gun, shit like that.
Hey!
Wait! No!
That's my favorite fucking scene. And you ruined it for me.
Oh, Sean, go
you
ahead.
You ruined it for me.
Go ahead.
My favorite scene. My favorite scene is when Clint Eastwood can't jump the building and he's falling down, and John Malkovich goes to pick him up, and he pulls his gun, and John Malkovich puts his mouth over the gun. That was totally improvised, and totally made Clint Eastwood laugh. By the way, when he did it, and what's crazy about it is the manic look on John Malkovich's face when he does it, because it feels like he's wanting them to die together, because he knows if he pulls the trigger, they're both gone.
Yeah.
And it's like they're live together, die together. It's like a pact.
Yeah.
Sorry, Ed.
I was about to say that. That's exactly what I was about to say. And what's so fun is like you actually see him smile right in that scene, and that smile is actually genuine because Clint Eastwood is actually laughing at the part. Peterson just kept the scene into the movie and shit, dude. So I think that was pretty cool. But regarding to Peterson, man. I read something about like he was very intimidated directing Clint Eastwood in this film, but he said that it went away after the first day. And he said that what Clint told him is that I won't interfere, but if you want my advice, I will be there for you. Otherwise, I'll leave you alone. And he never challenged Peterson's direction. I think that goes a fucking long ways, man. It's his movie, you know?
Well, I was listening to a interview with Tom Hanks about working with Clint Eastwood, and Tom Hanks he starts out by saying, Clint Eastwood treats the actors like horses. Everyone is a little skittish, a little shy, and he just wants to come in and just kind of rub their side and say, it's all right, come on in. And he doesn't say action. He kind of does this little thing with his finger and spins it around. Everyone spins it around. He goes, okay, let's get it going. Let's try it. And he does a take, and he'll go, well, let's try that one more time. I think we got it. And he'll move on. And I think that calmness of a direction, when you're used to controlling a set like that, and you have a director who might be a little skittish, what better person to work with than someone who's done 600 fucking movies?
Exactly.
In a calm,
he's worked with the
like,
best.
He's not a control freak of a scene. You know, he doesn't care. He just wants to get it right for the director. He's trusting in that vision. Yeah. So.
Nice.
Jeremiah, you didn't go your favorite scene, but I wanted to say I thought about it. I do want to I have a 1B, and that was the 1A. The 1B actually was the very end when he was talking to Mitch or John with Frank, and they're in the elevator, and he was kind of talking to Renee. It was just like, you know, you're gonna shoot or what? Like, you know, fucking shoot me. You know, he was trying to. It was just awesome. Like, I liked that scene. Like, he was, that was one of my, that was a really cool scene. And then, like, I knew what was in the very end is like, aim high. And that's when John, it clicked to John, like, you son of a bitch. Like, you weren't talking to me this whole time. You were setting me up. And it was just, it showed another side of Frank that I was just like, oh, so he's always thinking also a couple steps ahead. And this time he got him.
Everything that's leading up to the final part of the movie, it doesn't leave you disappointed.
No.
You know, the music, it's like it goes right to your bones and shit, you know, and you're literally seeing both chess masters at it, and it's about to actually go down. And when it goes down, it is the ultimate fucking save. And the best scene is when they actually get the president out of the building, and it's chaotic, man. I mean, I've never seen anything like it where they're just like, go. Just, I have like this whole routine.
Yeah.
That, I thought that was one of the coolest scenes. I was like, oh shit, dude, that felt good.
I will say that one of the things that I appreciate about the movie is, well, let me ask you this. Did you care about the president at all?
Do we even know about the president?
I didn't even know president. I mean, yeah.
We don't know.
I didn't know anything about him.
I cared about the Secret Service people more. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah. But I mean, I think this, what this movie subconsciously did was like, it showed you where the mind of the Secret Service agents are, as opposed to, doesn't really matter who the president is. We're protecting the office, and all of them had the same mentality.
We're protecting the United Every States of America. We're protecting
right from John Mahoney up. It's like, even Gary Cole, who I thought, Gary Cole was the most sniveling little asshole of a character I've ever seen in a film. And I could have watched this movie 20 times and I would not have known it was him until somebody said Gary Cole was in this movie. I was like, that's fucking Gary Cole.
The very end, I think the last time, what are you doing here? You're not supposed to be here. Son of a bitch, he's trying to save the president.
Yeah. Oh, dude. I saw this online here because I guess Jigsaw's in the movie and shit, the actor. You know, and I read this comment and made me laugh. He's like, when Jigsaw goes to sleep, he checks under the bed for Eastwood.
I thought that was the funniest thing, dude.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Renee Rousseau, who, you know, has turned out over the years to be just a fantastic actress. I felt like in this movie, she kind of faded into the love interest role and didn't punch up the story. But then again, I don't think anyone really punched up the story except for Clint Eastwood and John Malkovich. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had great actors like, you know, Frasier's father, what's his name? John Mahoney.
Yeah, Mahoney.
Who I think is fantastic. You had Gary Cole, obviously we talked about him. There's so many good actors in this movie, mm-hmm. but they kind of all fade into the background, including Renee Rousseau, when you put them against Clint Eastwood and John Malkovich. I mean, we talked a little bit about I want to say Dermot Mulroney again. And that's
Dylan right McDermott.
One. He's not Dermot Mulroney. He's McDermott.
The guy from
Dylan, man. Yeah. He's a Dylan.
Gosh darn it.
John Denver.
That's David Duchovny.
That's the same guy.
John Denver.
Different guy. David Duchovny is in X-Files. Anyway, I think that all the actors and actresses kind of faded in. And that was a shame because Rene Rousseau kind of had an interesting character. I think that Jeremiah was right. The love story was a little forced. I kind of would almost rather them had that banter that they had, like, you know, if they would have just kept with that little cat and mouse banter, I think it would have been better than having an actual love story. Although we didn't talk about one of my favorite scenes, and that's when they go to have their love, they make love making, and they drop all their stuff on the floor, all their hit sticks and their guns and their all that shit, and she gets called away and he goes, oh shit. Now I'm going to put all that stuff back on.
Felt very Naked Gun, by the way. It felt like that, dude.
Naked Gun copied it, didn't they?
I think so, yeah, dude.
Brandon had a little extra chuckle for that one, just because that's one of my favorite lines.
I watched that and I said, oh, this is
Sean.
What
did you guys think about Renee Rousseau? Sorry.
No, you know what? It's weird. Looking at her filmography, I had thought that this was like my first time seeing Renee Rousseau, but it wasn't because I saw her in Lethal Weapon 3. I'd seen her in Major League. And I feel like
Yep.
When I honestly, when I mentioned this one and I said last week that we were doing this one, I had kind of forgotten that she was even in it, right? Because to me, it was it's the Clint Eastwood, John Malkovich show. And I feel like it's got a great supporting cast, but in a lot of ways, it's just that they're there to just kind of keep the story going and support the two, you know, main contenders. And I think that that's, it makes sense. I mean, they filmed, you know, they filled a whole 2+ hour movie with it, but at the same time, it would have been nice to get a little bit more background, to get a little bit more, I don't know, perspective as to why we should be even sadder about, you know, damn it, Dylan McDermott's character. Because we get the idea that he's got a family and he wants to go home and hug his wife and kid. Like, that's great, but man, have a dinner over with them and see them, and then all of a sudden we care more about them. Give us a little bit more of Rene Russo away from Clint Eastwood, and we care more about her. I think that would have been cool. Add an extra 15 minutes and give us more exposition on these other characters.
This movie was long already.
It would have been cool. I would have been cool to like see Dylan or Renee. I want to say Renee because, I mean, obviously Mitch was all over Frank here, right? Like, he was following him and like he was infatuated with him. It would have been cool to see like Renee get captured or like, you know, used as a pawn somewhere. I don't know.
Or killed.
Or, yeah, I mean, Al died. It would have been cool. Al already did die, but it would have been cool if they would have like made it seem like Mitch, like he brought them in and purposely for Frank to decide, kill me or save your friend Al, you know, and instead, you know, he just couldn't jump the ledge. You know, Al died. Okay, cool. That's sad. I mean, that was sad. There was no much behind him enough to really feel sad about him.
It kind of like when Tommy Lee Jones decides to die in freaking Space Cowboys. I know it's a week old, but
I'm going to say that. I didn't want to say that, but
I'm going to say it.
I mean, bro, the scene that you just described right there, man, it reminded me a lot of Dark Knight. You know, Joker. Yeah. you know, either you save Rachel or you save Harvey. Yeah.
So I wish they would have added that, and they didn't. They just like left it out.
So before we wrap this up, I just want to go over Renee Russo's filmography from 1992 to when she got out of acting in 96 about, or no, I'm sorry, 99 when she went for her kids. Okay. So she left Hollywood to go raise her kids basically in 1990, 2000, but check this out. 1992, Lethal Weapon 3.
Sweet.
93, In the Line of Fire. Major League 2, 94. Outbreak, 95. Get Shorty, 95. Tin Cup, 96.
Nice.
Ransom, 96.
What?
Buddy, I've never heard of, 97. 98, Lethal Weapon 4, 99, Thomas Crown Affair. She had fucking like 10 movies that were fantastic.
She was the
And then 90s. She's like, peace.
Talking about ending
and
on
then
the top.
She got back into acting Thor in 2011.
Yeah.
Hey, next season, the Rene Russo podcast. Let's do it.
Yeah, for sure.
That brings us to the end of review. Now it's time on the podcast where each of the hosts provides a score on the following scale. James Carney, can you please provide the scale?
It's going to be 0, the perfect movie. You don't need shit to enjoy it. 1, a feel-good first cocktail. 2, a happy buzz. 3, you're going to Uber or Lyft home. 4, rough morning to watch a shame. 5, blackout shit-faced spring break drunk.
Gentlemen,
write your scores.
Yeah,
okay. I'm ready. I think I'm ready. I'm as ready as I'm going to be. Aim high, guys. Aim high.
Aim small, miss small.
Okay. 1.
Patriot, great
two,
movie.
3.
Oh, okay.
I can't see.
Okay.
Sure, Okay. Yeah.
Wow, look at this.
Okay. Well, hey, you know what? It's my movie, so I'll start. I think that this movie is great. It has been years and years since I've seen it. So when I saw that I had a nice plethora of movies to choose from Space Cowboys. So again, Sean, thank you for the great setup. In the Line of Fire stuck out because it's a movie that I remember seeing and watching several times, you know, in my younger days and always just being so obsessed with John Malkovich's character. On the rewatch, I would say that I was more disappointed than I was pleasantly surprised, not with Malkovich, but with the whole production completely. I felt like it was a little imbalanced. I thought that it had some great, absolutely great moments, but honestly, outside of Malkovich, I didn't really give a shit about any of the characters. I didn't think that the character development was as strong as it could have been. I'm not saying it wasn't good, but it just wasn't as good as it could have been. I do agree that, like we said and have said several times today, the love story was just kind of took me out of the moment. That being said, I think that, you know, in hindsight, I might have gone a little bit bad with the score. I should have gone better with the score because of Malkovich. Because, I mean, if you're talking about a movie where a single performance really carries the entire movie, I think that you can say that Malkovich carries this movie. And I put him on the same level of Chigurh, of the Joker, of Hannibal Lecter, like I've said, you know, a bunch of times today. So I think it's a great movie. Mm-hmm. I think it's worth the watch. It is a movie that if I see it on, you know, if I'm flipping through and TBS has it on, I'm going to sit there and I'm going to watch it, commercials or no commercials. I think that it's not an average film. I think it's a little bit lower than average film, which is too bad because I think it could have been fucking phenomenal. So I'm going to give it a happy buzz with a shot and then some. So I'm giving it a 2.85 for me. And I'm going to throw it out to James Carney. Do you want, Jer's going to take it.
I'll take it. I'll piggyback what you were saying right there, man, because I feel like this is one of those timeless popcorn movies that made the movies of the 90s fucking awesome, dude. You know, it's a treat to watch two iconic actors play the ultimate chess match, and I love shit like that, you know? The movie has issues, don't get me wrong, man. It feels a little dated, you know, of the product of its time, you know? The love story, I could have done it without, you know? Sometimes it drags, and at times you felt like Eastwood was kind of on the ropes throughout the film, man. But however, I agree with you 100%. You watch this film because of John Malkovich, dude. He gives one of the best performances of that decade, one of the greatest actors of our time, and probably one of the greatest actors that never played a James Bond villain, man. Seriously, dude. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the reason why you watch this movie.
It's
here,
true,
dude.
Sean, he hasn't.
Who played a James Bond villain?
He didn't.
He never played a James Bond villain, dude. I think he's he should have played. He could have played a James Bond villain, dude. I'm just saying. He's
that
good.
For sure. Yeah. I totally agree with that.
To me, this is just an average movie, man. 2.5. It's a good movie. It's a little dated, but John Malkovich, one of the best performances that you're going to see in a long time, dude. So 2.5 for me, guys.
Yes.
Eddie.
My name is James Carney. Please don't give my real identity away.
Booth.
There was two movies that I compared this one with another one, and it was The Jackal. The Jackal of Bruce Willis and Richard Gere. And I always used to thought that one was a better movie. I just need to watch that one again. But rewatching this movie, I enjoyed it. Like, it was a movie that it just brought back a lot of memories, and I don't think I have watched this enough to originally give my previous score. I was thinking in my head, and then I watched it. I was like, okay, it was – you know, Jeremiah said it good. It's like, it doesn't hold up sometimes in certain areas, but it still is a great movie. Clint Eastwood and obviously the great John Malkovich, John Montana.
Yeah.
Yes. So
John Montana.
Yeah. So I know, right? So I enjoyed him every time he was on the scene, and him and Clint, they I enjoyed when they were bickering. Like, that was making me enjoy the movie more. And there is some holes in the movie, I think Sean also said a great saying. You know what? Like, it made you didn't realize, but you didn't really care about the president. Now I was caring about the Secret Service people more and their job, their day to day, and it was crazy how their life was, and I was intrigued with that lifestyle. Never wanted to do it, just intrigued with it. But you know, this movie is a little bit below than the average movie, but I don't think it's the bee's knees either. So I think it's right below you're doing an Uber lifting home. So I'm doing this, what was it? A 2.9. So this for me was a 2.9 is what I gave it. So
almost Uber, but not quite.
Right below it. It was better than that. It was around Space Cowboys, but it had me at John. So John Malkovich definitely pulled me in a little bit harder.
It's like, no, I'll take it right with you, man.
Yeah, I'll finish this up. There are about four movies that are near and dear to my heart, or that were political thrillers in the 90s. And it was like Absolute Power, No Way Out, In the Line of Fire and Murder at 1600, which was a Wesley Snipes and Diane Lane movie with Alan Alda, I believe.
Sean, you're a No Way Out fan?
Love No Way Out.
Oh, it's Kevin fuck, Costner. Sean.
Fuck yeah.
Kevin Costner and Gene Hackman?
Gene Hackman. And Gene Hackman's an absolute power as well. He's oh, president.
Dude. Good
so,
job.
But those four movies are, to me, like, if I always watch movies in spurts, right? Like, these are all, like, protect president movies. So I really like this. I like this genre. I like this idea of honor and America and corruption. And it's just really it's interesting to me. This movie, to me, is one of the better movies in that genre. Clint Eastwood was fantastic. He's his usual Clint Eastwood charming self. John Malkovich puts in a performance, in my opinion, is one of the greatest villain performances of all time. We're talking about putting him up with Hannibal Lecter and with with Terminator and with all the great villains, Sugar, that just keep coming. His voice is fantastic. I don't think the movie you guys said that it didn't hold up. I think it does hold up wonderfully for 1993. It's a time capsule.
Yeah.
And you kind of get what's going on in there. It's not trying to be modern. It's almost trying to be a historical record of the time. I don't think this movie works today. If you look at what's been produced, there's those – I can't remember the name of the movie. It's like White House Down. Mm-hmm. Gerard Butler?
Was it Fallen Freeman? Angel or something?
White House or something has fallen.
White House Down was Channing Tatum and Jamie Foxx, I think.
Yes, I'm sorry, but there was a bunch of something fallen. Olympus has fallen. But that was kind of the same concept of a Secret Service agent trying to save the president, and they make you care about the president. This to me is a beautiful time capsule of a bygone era where country was more important than person and party. And I think that is a interesting and fun thing to watch. As far as rating this movie, I look at our mandate and what does this do for cinema? I think that it doesn't do much to revolutionize cinema, but it does definitely, it is the culmination of years and decades of this type of movie and perfecting it. It was, of all, you could say a lot of bad things about the 80s movies and the rough pornographic, the cursing and the swearing. That always bothered me. I feel like it finally got refined, but you still had the noir aspect of it, the noir aspect of filmmaking. And I think that, it's not a big jump from the Maltese Falcon to In the Line of Fire. There's not a big jump there. Anyway, so I give this movie a 1.5. I think that's it's a feel good first cocktail with a little extra shot there.
Nice.
So you liked it better than Space Cowboys?
I thought that this was if you were going to put this on a spectrum of cinema versus a movie, this is closer to cinema than it is than Space Cowboys ever will be.
Yeah.
And I think John Malkovich's performance, it's very difficult for me to say it's above average or a below average movie when you have a performance that was nominated for Academy Award, number one. Number two, was probably one of the greatest villain portrayals
ever.
Yeah.
If ever.
So I want to know if I'm in kind of the same theme of movies with you, Sean. So during the 90s, I have a certain movies for Saving the President, and this is one of them. I also like Executive Decision with Kurt Russell and Steven Seagal, and then there was also Air Force One.
Anyway, keep going. Nice.
Oh, I got to support the 80s movies, man. Okay, listen, I know it was really a bad decade, but in the 90s they decided to go one step beyond and fuck a pie and shit. Okay, I'm just saying to you, okay?
No, and I'm not saying the 80s. Look at so my problem with the 80s.
That was for Brandon right there.
Yeah, no, but Jeremiah, I just want to clarify.
Go for it. Do it.
Like a movie, like I remember Predator 2, right? Predator 2 just. You had such graphic violence. I remember not being able to watch the movies when I was a kid because my mom and dad were like, no, you can't
strip
watch
the bones down and all you saw was a naked body. And yeah, no, hey,
I'm just going to let you know that movie was made in 1991. So I'm sorry. That was a product of the
90s. I'm sorry.
1999, they just broke out the, okay, we were too clean. Let's make the 2000s the old-fashioned American pie. Like, it was just...
Right. Oh, my God, dude. Brandon, I love you.
Hashtag 1999.
This season, we might get America Pie 2.
Oh, my God. Could we?
When you take the score and divide by four, what does that give? Excuse me. In the Line of Fire, an average rating
of? It gives us a 2.4375.
Boom.
2.4375.
And where does that put us on the list of movies that we've reviewed there, Jeremiah?
It is tied with two films on the 54th spot.
Oh.
And what are those two films?
Nightmares on Elm Street and A Quiet Place 2.
Ooh.
And what is a better movie than
Quiet Place 2.
Than In the Line of Fire?
I don't think it's better than Quiet Place 2.
So what's a better movie than this right here? So you got The Rock, Die Hard, Home Alone 2, North by Northwest, The Greatest Showman. That's these movies are better than this movie right here.
Okay. And what movies are worse?
Grease, The Hangover, Moulin Rouge, Rocky, Terminator, and the classic A Knight's Tale with Pitch Perfect.
Terminator was probably
that's
where it is.
Yeah, Terminator 1.
Terminator 2 was.
I mean, Terminator 2 was where it was at. And you were the one who sank Terminator 1.
I didn't like it, but I would just say.
Just so you know.
My thing is,
you'd sank every movie.
Revolutionizes the movies. Like, that's the thing that I go with. And Terminator 1 did where I feel like In the Line of Fire.
Sean, you also save movies. I just want to let that be known. You both equally.
Oh, no, I totally do.
You play your part well.
I would never suggest otherwise.
Just to let you know, Sean, to make you feel better because it is your birthday, Terminator 2 is in the top 10 of our ratings.
Yeah.
So it's a 0.43. So
hold on, I think I have two selections in the top 10. Just so
shut up, Sean.
Sound of Music and Terminator
2. We'll have to revisit this at some point. All right, so that means that we are at the end of the podcast episode, and it's time for one of our gentlemen to tell us which movie we're going to be watching and reviewing next week. So, since Eddie, our best friend Eduardo, has the next selection, Ed, what are we watching and why are we watching it?
Yes, so we haven't yet picked a director to follow. So this was how I took it as, and I'm going to go with Wolfgang Peterson. Or Wolfgang Puck, I like to call him.
Yes.
Never Any Story?
Right. That was up there. I would set you guys up really close because it was locked us up real hard. I'm going to pick
The horse. The horse has been in multiple movies. The horse. The horse is your only option out.
So,
I know there's suspense here, but I'm going to just. He's done a couple of good movies out there, but I'm going to pick the Troy. Starring Brad Pitt and a lot of other actors and actresses.
Let's get the sword and sandals going.
Yeah, and the reason why is I was a very big Achilles fan of Greek mythology, and so I was just always about Achilles.
I will say this:
a long time.
I was scrolling through Instagram today, and I fell on this one little reel, and it was this guy who was playing Wheel of Fortune. And it said the Greek god or Roman god, whoever he is, Achilles. And he had won like $1 million and a trip to like Spain and all this stuff. And he goes, the mythical god Achilles. And it's all I can think about. It's Achilles. It's Achilles. It's Achilles.
Can we let that pass?
I'm sorry.
Ed.
We have not
had a sword and sandals epic since Gladiator, I think.
We're going to get some Brian Cox.
Oh, okay. Brian.
This also has a great song. The movie has a great song by Josh Groban, so I'm excited about that. All right. So if you're a fan of the if you enjoyed our review or a fan of the episode, please subscribe wherever you're listening and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. You can also find us on Instagram at the Dot Gentleman Podcast. You can visit our website, thegentlemanpodcast.com. Or if you want to, you can reach out by email at hosts with an hosts at thegentlemanpodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we just want to take this moment, now that we're a couple episodes into season 5, to thank all of our new listeners. We've seen a good upsurge in in viewers and listeners. And we're excited to please ask you to tell your neighbors, your friends, anyone you can. Word of mouth means everything to this podcast, and we really want to see it grow from last year. So we're going to bug you up, you know, every couple episodes to talk to your friends about it, ask your friends about it if they've listened, and
talk shit about us, please. That's fine.
Yeah, just absolutely. Yeah.
Just don't talk shit about
Brandon
me.
Brandon has the worst taste in movies ever. So
I like it.
I still stand by Vanilla Sky. I stand by that.
I like it when people don't like. I like it when people don't like that I also voted zero, and they just I get blasted.
I feel like if we were in Vegas, we should have a bet going. Like, is Eddie going to give a zero this season? What do you think? Is there a chance?
Mm-hmm. That's a good.
No, I don't think so either.
There's been only a handful.
No. I'll give it 5-1.
Okay, 5-1. 5-1. Okay, well then.
It might be.
What's the over under of one? Over and under one odds. Under or over?
Oh, under. I actually don't know how betting. I don't know how betting works. So
Sean, that's like foreign to me. Like, yeah,
I don't know what that means. I'm just a guess. Yes, of course, yeah, of course.
Bears are gonna win.
All right, guys. See you next week for Troy. Thanks.
Cheers,
everyone. Troy,
nicely done. Love it. I'm like, Troy's a good call.